You're listening to the Tech Talk Show. Hi there, my name is Sue Nelson, and for the next hour, we're going to be talking about all things tech. I'm joined by my lovely fellow presenter, Paul Armstrong, who's the author of Disruptive Technologies. Good morning, Paul.
Morning.
How are you doing?
Not bad.
Okay. We're going to talk this morning about our Tech Talk 22, which is just been published on techradar.com. And basically, a whole bunch of judges were in a room for a whole day, really, looking through 70 or 80 people who'd submitted incredible pieces of tech that we sort of analysed. And then after much arguments and whatever, our judging panel came up with our favourite Tech Talk 22. So, Paul, I know that you've worked in America and you've worked over here, and you write books and you appear on television and you know quite a lot about tech. There's some interesting ones here, and what I was finding with the judging panel is that there were some certain themes that I think we were seeing emerging, really. One of them were, we got submitted quite a lot of robotics. Mm-hmm. And I just find it amusing that people think that robots should look like people. Why? Because if you're asking them to do a certain task, you know, they don't... I just think people feel comfortable. And because of films and all that sort of gaming, I think people think that a robot should look like a person.
Yeah.
Whereas in actual fact, some of the things we were seeing were really incredible and didn't look anything like a person. But robotics is a new thing. I mean, it's going to be key, isn't it?
Yeah, I think what's really interesting about the robotics industry is, as you say, the humanoid element. When it becomes too human, or there's like that, I think they call it the uncanny valley or something, where it's basically, that's creepy. You get to a period where you go, that's not quite human, and I don't like it. But like you say, there's everything's on a spectrum, and robotics is no different. And the earlier parts of that is when, you know, robots can do things that humans, either it's too dangerous to, they don't want to do.
Or it's too repetitive.
You know, and that's the thing. And this is what I love about robotics, is because it's now fundamentally getting into that interesting thing, which we call the purpose of life. Is it to slave away somewhere at 8 hours a day, you know, and be miserable and go home and binge watch a box set and that sort of thing and make somebody else rich, you know? So a really interesting sort of topic area.
And the thing about jobs, though, you know, people are worried about the fact that a lot of those lower grade jobs are going to go. So what are people going to do? I mean, have you got any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, personally speaking, I'm all for lifelong learning and like retraining, reskilling, upskilling and that sort of stuff. There are, if that's a very, geographical issue that you're describing there, because there are some nations who just, it's not in their DNA, you know, and that sort of thing. And then there are others who are from a very young age taught, you're going to be doing 15 million jobs, you've got to get this mentality in you and that sort of stuff. And there are some people just with very old populations that kind of go like, look, I put in my time, can I just cash out of this, thanks, you know, and that sort of thing.
I think I'm hitting that bit.
But I mean, if you're going to live till like 80, 100, which is, that's what they're saying, babies now are going to be living to and that sort of stuff, we've got to start figuring out, A, what do we want to do with that time? And B, when we get to the end of it and our bodies are sort of like checking out themselves, can we fix things like, what do you call it, dementia, Alzheimer's, all of those sorts of things? Like, we've got some serious problems to fix.
So some quality of life there. Mm. The other thing that we saw when we were judging is this sort of field of haptics. Now, that's, I might have got this wrong, but that's all about the sort of touching and feeling and the technology around that, you know, and using touch and feel to actually instruct and to, you know, to make decisions and all that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. Have you seen any advances in that, or is it something you're excited by?
Yeah, very much so. Something I touched on in Disruptive Technologies and sort of those new sort of burgeoning areas, and haptics is definitely one of those. For me, I see a lot of interesting stuff happening in MIT and those sorts of places where they actually have a haptics division. So they're actually, you know, looking at the future interfaces of the future and figuring out, you know, what is it that people are going to need? You know, is it being handed something by robotic hands, or is it, no, they don't actually need that. They just need the sort of gesture of something being given to them in order for them to feel like that's okay, you know? So it's a little bit sort of, again, on a spectrum of like how things are going to be interfaced with in the future. But really, haptics is an interesting one from a sort of like, what can we do standpoint, you know? It's not a lot. It's not an area where people have really sort of exposed themselves to yet.
Yeah, so fairly new. I'm sure it's going to affect the dental and medical world, you know, in terms of, you know, some of the developments there. But I do feel that the sort of voice recognition and haptics is going to completely change the way we do things. I mean, who's going to need to type, you know, when we crack all that sort of stuff? And who's going to need, you know, sort of a, you know, remote control? You're not, are you? It's going to be hand movements and it's going to be voice recognition.
Yeah, I mean, don't forget, we've had gesture and stuff for a long time. And they're not being fixed. You know, they are being fixed, but very slowly. Mm-hmm. And when you've, so when I wrote the book, I broke my tendons. And that's what I suffered, I had tenosynovitis. And I explored everything to do with getting voice into a computer, from dictation, translation, all of that sort of stuff. And it was still, you know, I would say a good 70% working. So when we do crack that 30%, I definitely think life will be amazing and that sort of stuff.
Very, very different.
But, yeah.
Well, we've got two studio guests here. We've got Heather Pickoff from, she's a UK Managing Director of Apps for Good. And we've got Phil Westcott as a Joint Managing Director of Filament. Phil, when we have a look at some of these things, again, a very, very strong thread through these 22 is artificial intelligence and machine learning. And that's not going to go away either, is it? It's going to underpin quite a lot of what we're doing.
No, I think the next decade is going to be dominated by AI, some of the haptics, the augmented realities we're seeing, and the Internet of Things. Those are really the three mega trends that we're seeing converging in industry and enterprise, but also in the startup world.
But artificial intelligence isn't something that people should be frightened of, is it? And there's a lot of horror stories in the media about, well, computers are going to talk to computers and they're just going to start making decisions and cut humans out, and there's going to be this, you know, there's going to be a war, and it's not like that at all, is it? There's some real good stuff happening, and without it, we're not going to advance as quickly as we want to.
Yeah, I think artificial intelligence has benefited but also suffered from the Hollywood perceptions of general artificial intelligence, which is these perceived robots, and it's the displacement of the role of the human. And it does get to the essence of what it is to be human, which is why we tend to be so disturbed about that prophecy. But actually, here and now, and that's really where Filament's been focused, is the benefits that everyone in their day job today can see from working with augmented intelligence systems. So yeah, I think there is there's a need for generally the population to understand that actually this is a technology that can be hugely valuable to the human race
and release us from some of the drudgery of what some people are doing.
As you were saying earlier.
Mm-hmm. And we were seeing some things here again. I'm turning to Heather. Is we were also seeing quite a lot of family and stuff aimed at children in terms of education to try and teach them coding and engineering and robotics. And we were seeing quite a few of these. And one of the things that we were sort of impressed by is that what it was trying to do is bring families together, actually, or children together to try and do this stuff and release them from their blooming smartphone or iPad or whatever it is. And actually then getting them into technology and solving some of those problems themselves. Is that the sort of thing that you're seeing?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, I think there's probably a growing realization that we know that young people are on, you know, the digital tools that you're talking about, but that doesn't mean they understand how they actually work. And I think there is also this sort of challenge of thinking of all young people as digital natives, because that takes time to build. So you really do need to help young people take that step back, understand, you know, this is something that you create. And how do you create that? You work together as a team, you look at the problem that you have, you trial different solutions, you get feedback. So yes, I think it's something that is growing in realization, and really fantastic, all the solutions coming out that also do bring families together to do that, because that yeah. time at home is really important.
And also, you know, you used to say, well, if you want to program your video or whatever it was, I don't know that now, but you know, get a child to do it for you because they understand it. There's a real thing I think where we can get families where younger people are actually, and children are actually, helping their parents through some of that technology. So it's two way, isn't it? It's not just one way.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's super empowering for young people, that they get to be the expert and they can exchange back and forth. They can be on that level playing field with either parents or aunts and uncles or other family friends. And it's actually a real exchange. It's not just the adult, which is where so much of the rest of their lives are just telling them what to do and what's important. They get to be equal with them.
Mm. And again, running through these, Paul, one of the things we were worried about is how are these people going to monetize some of these? There's some incredible developments in this Tech Talk 22.
Mm.
But actually, the ones that we've got here are people who were are successful to some degree, because if you can't monetize it, you're going to really struggle, aren't you?
Yeah, no, for sure. I think monetization is always going to be a big part of, you know, industry. But lists like this help for that very reason, because it gives them a validity and it sort of puts them in a new sort of strata. And like you say, this list isn't the newest and bravest and that sort of stuff, but there are people who are demonstrating like real core skills of entrepreneurship and sort of technology now.
Yeah. Another theme was we were seeing more products and tech being made for women from scratch, mm-hmm. you know, from zero, as opposed to sort of bastardizing male products. And as you said earlier, before we came on air, making them pink and then somehow that's okay. It makes it female.
It's horrible.
There's lots more of this stuff actually now, realizing that the huge proportion of, you know, a big chunk of consumers, of course, are women. So can you design things from scratch?
I hear over 50%.
Really? It's funny, that, isn't it? But that's an important area as well, isn't it? And if you're going to go into entrepreneurship and tech, design stuff for women. Blimey.
Yeah. I like it when women design stuff for women. I like it when men who have talked to women design stuff. You know, so long as you've included the end user into it, I'm pretty sure you won't usually run into too many problems. But again, checks and balances all the time. Femtech is one of the most interesting areas. There's so many problems that women, as a man, I would never be aware of and that sort of stuff. But when you look at products like Sheepy and all those sorts of things, they came from like female entrepreneurs going, I have nothing for me, like I've got to create it myself, you know. Yeah. And I think stuff like that, you know, it doesn't have to be tech, but you know, femtech is one of those areas which is absolutely rocketing up and lots of people are investing in it. So
I mean, one of the companies on the Tech Talk 22 was Metail. And what they've done is they've tried, it's patented technology, and they've tried to build a sort of e-commerce model where the photography allows you to capture a human body size and shape so that you can then get your garment designed. Because a big issue for me is the returns. Mm. So if you are an internet company and you're mailing stuff out, then there's going to be the level of returns must be huge, because buying clothes on the internet is really difficult. Yeah. So people are buying them and going, if it doesn't fit, I'll just send it back. Well, I mean, that as an efficient model is pretty rubbish. So we've got to find ways of people being able to interpret better whether something fits them.
Yeah. Some companies register up to 60% return rate of online purchases, which is absolutely huge. And you can only imagine the money that's being wasted, the environment, all of that sort of stuff. Amazon's interestingly come into this market recently where they're, I think it's called Amazon Shopping Box or something. And it's basically a box where you can pack in 10 things or 8 things or whatever. But the more you keep, the more discount you get. But also you get to have multiple sizes and you just send back what you don't use. And it's kind of a really interesting sort of system, but I didn't like it for one reason, is it doesn't solve the problem. And this Metail absolutely does solve that problem of, if you get it at the source, and I'm, you know, a size 2, as we all like to think, you know, that sort of stuff, then you can basically head that off at the pass.
If I squint a lot, I'm sort of size 10, but in general, no. And the other thing that I really liked about what they were doing is they were also tackling issues about body perception and size, because, you know, that is a real issue. And, you know, you've got models that look like, we were saying, you know, size, whatever. Mm. And what they were doing is by allowing users to buy clothes that actually suit them and fit them. Mm. You know, that they're sort of cutting away at some of those ridiculous, you know, models that are unachievable.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that's still going to happen because you've got the Instagram folks that are coming now and figuring out they can make a quick buck. If they look good in a bikini, they go, oh, and buy this Apple. And you're like, oh, fine, whatever, you know. It's not necessarily working on me, but I know that there are a lot of younger people out there studies are showing that it's absolutely working. So, again, you know, we have to fight these things on multiple fronts. But, you know, technology that gets you to fit clothes, absolutely amazing.
Yeah,
all for it.
Very good. And, Phil, another thing we were seeing a lot is obviously cybersecurity and secure communications. The one thing that was coming up again and again is you can have design fixes and you can have processes and stuff that design out some of these issues or build in warning systems. But actually, the huge proportion of stuff is people making mistakes by accident or rogue behaviour, which is very, very difficult to pick up. And of course, email and stuff like that is just, I mean, people are sending emails all over the place. And you can easily send out an attachment or something that was supposed to be for somebody and it's gone to the wrong person. And we were seeing quite a lot of AI and all that sort of stuff trying to spot when somebody accidentally done something wrong. And cybersecurity, again, is something that you come across quite a lot.
Yeah, I mean, that use case of looking for potential rogue behaviour is one that AI has been applied to for many, many years, actually. The amount of data now that surrounds our lives and we exchange with others is making cybersecurity a real threat, because we do reveal ourselves to the cyberspace. We reveal information, personal information, the whole time. And therefore, there is real concern about rogue behaviour and inappropriate use of our personal information.
Hmm.
I think over the next 10 years, we're going to see individuals taking charge of their own data and being a lot more protective of it. I think we, as a nation, as a global population, we haven't really seen the value that our own data really really expresses about ourselves.
It's not just the value, it's the danger of it. I mean, you won't get me on Facebook for love nor money because of what they do with your data.
Mm.
You're laughing at me there, Paul. But just
a wry smile, yep.
Well, no, but you know, young people will just, their footprint on social media and what it gives away about them is huge. You know, about even when you're on holiday and you're not in your house. And, yeah. You know, I mean, it's massive, really.
Yeah.
And they're quite unaware, I think, that everything about them almost is known.
So there's two buckets to always talk about when you get a sort of loaded question like that. the stuff that you don't realise that you're creating, the metadata around where you are, like location and that sort of stuff. And then you've got your overt omissions, as they say. And for me, when people, and I get asked this question all the time, I'm like, how much should I share? And I'm like, as much as you're comfortable sharing. You know, there are sometimes when you can overlay two elements, you go, that means X, Y, and Z. And that's when it becomes dangerous. But if you think about it, we've been doing it for a number of years. There's no way to put that genie back in the box. We can only be better moving forward. And again, you know, change your behaviors. You know, if you get value out of a platform, that's fantastic. The second you stop getting value out of that, cut it off. You know, or figure out why, and do you want to get it back, and that sort of thing.
But you're laying a trail the whole time, unless you know what to do, and you can sort of cut that off, really.
Mm.
But, you know, just going onto Google and searching, or going to YouTube, if you overlay that with a LinkedIn profile, with your Facebook, with your purchases,
yeah.
Somebody's got a really amazingly detailed picture of you.
Well, if that were true, we'd all be absolutely happy with what we're getting sold and shown for adverts. So we know that that's not true.
Yeah.
They're very bad at doing lots of things with the data that we do give them. Like you say, when it does get overlaid, that is when the issues sort of arise. But for me, when I sort of hear that sort of argument and that sort of thing, I go, you could argue about technologies throughout the time. Everyone that's come off, you knew a bit more.
Yeah.
The thing that's really sort of like changed us and polarized a lot of people is the mobileness of it. You know, they do know where you are and that sort of stuff. You know, we've all watched CSI for 16 years and feel like, oh, well, if we did get lost, we could just be pinged and like someone could find you. We're like, but wait, are they doing that when we're not? You know, and that sort of stuff. There is a great Mozilla festival which happened recently, and it was all about privacy, and it's called The Glass Door, if you want to look at it online and that sort of stuff. And they are launching, I think they've launched it actually, an app which you can download, and it helps you do this digital detox and that sort of stuff. And we'll put a link in
digital
description.
Digital detox, I like that. Yeah,
yeah, and some of the advice they've given is pretty sort of strong, but again, it's needed in this sort of day and age. You do sometimes need to, you know, just a release, as it were, and go, right, if I delete that and I put it back in, how do I then start again? That sort of stuff.
So, So that's the Tech Talk 22. Go and check it out. We found it absolutely fascinating, and that's our view of the sort of 22 companies that you need to watch for all sorts of reasons. So I'll definitely go on there. I'm going to do it again next year, because it really helped to see what those sort of threads and themes were.
And that's
on techradar.com. Techradar.com.
Brilliant.
Finishing with that, over to you, Phil. So Phil Westcott, MD of Filament. Tell us all about Filament and how you sort of came to start it and be there.
So Filament really responds to the fact that there is a gap in the market serving enterprise with a pragmatic way to get started with their artificial intelligence and machine learning journey. There was a huge amount of, and there has been a huge amount of buzz in the market about AI. But what can be done right now is genuinely changing the way people are doing their jobs and giving organisations a differentiation versus their competition. So we've worked primarily with large enterprise in embedding an understanding of what AI can do to their industry. And we've been running for 18 months now. We've grown a UK team, and we're now looking to expand internationally.
So can you give us an example of one of those projects, you know, without revealing the client, but can you just sort of run us through how that would work with you know, a typical type client?
Sure. So think of a professional services industry, for example, where you've got someone who is constantly looking for changes in the global taxation system, and they're looking for changes in rules that might affect the way they will do business and advise their clients. So keeping on top of knowledge in that context.
God, expensive and very, very time consuming.
Exactly. Mm. And we talked earlier about the drudgery.
You know where to find it, for a start.
Yeah, the drudgery of our workday. The promise of AI is no matter what line of work you're in, the drudgery can be replaced or at least reduced so that you can focus on higher value tasks. That's in the fairly mundane area of tax. But now apply that to more the creative industries. We're working on a project to help the naming of brands, which you would have thought would be quite a cool process. You get in a room, you talk about the brand, you fire some ideas around. But even that process has a certain amount of drudgery. You need to understand whether a name means something rude in Swahili before you release it to the global market.
Like Bimbo bread in Spain, yeah, and stuff like that, yeah.
Exactly. And then some really impressive entrepreneurs who have come to us looking for advice on how they build AI into their solutions from fields such as addressing the user's conditions of having Parkinson's disease to how does someone with autism flourish in their career. They can actually tap into chatbots in the case of the latter to get guidance on how they can be more effective in the workplace. So we've really coined the term, if you like, bottling the expertise or the IP of an organization. How do you look at what's really great about your organization and get your experts to train an artificial intelligence system so you can scale that expertise?
So what you're saying then is you would go in and somebody would say, so for example, in my company I've got 20 people and they're all great, but quite a few of them have to do, like we all do, I suppose, bits of our work that we don't really like because it is repetitive or it's boring or it's mundane, you know, it might be a bit of research that we've got to do, all sorts of other things. You would come into my organisation and say, actually, see all these things that are happening here, we can devolve that to something else, you know, in terms of AI, we can learn off it so that your people in the organisation actually move up a step and do stuff that's more intellectually, you know, challenging because that's what they're good at and they're clever and, you know, whatever. So it releases them, but actually makes the company more efficient at the same time. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. And you would have heard a lot of people talking about how it's all in the data. Mm. We'd look at your organisation and what unique data sources do you have and what unique expertise do you have that makes you special in the market. And the promise of AI is by bottling that into these machine learning models, these knowledge graphs, these intelligent systems, you can then scale your unique value to greater heights, take it internationally, make your workers all the more effective at delivering the unique services that you have.
But what about that sort of lag and that gap that you get, though? So how do I move my staff from, you know, from doing stuff that they used to actually going up and then trusting the sort of systems underneath? You know, how do you move from that? It's quite hard. It's okay, I can see if you've got critical mass and you've got hundreds of employees, you've probably got you're able to do that because you can move people around a bit more. But it's quite hard, isn't it? We've suddenly got a gap.
Mm. I think there's a big area of cultural change that needs to be addressed. But we were talking before the show about our children who are entering the workplace in 5-10 years' time. They're going to be so comfortable working hand in hand with computers, seamlessly, not through laptops, but through, you know, haptic suits, head-up displays in their contact lenses, an earpiece, giving them knowledge and insight into the work they're doing day in, day out. We have another project with an oil and gas company that works on health and safety for their workers. So the foreman can be in constant communication with each of their workers and can be reading their bio signals for warnings of someone being overheated, stressed, or in danger of medical conditions.
So a lot of that's going to be predictive, isn't it? Predicting those things, those scenarios.
Well, in the first instance, it's about giving you real-time insight. Mm. But once you start collecting the data, the promise of machine learning is you start to spot patterns. You start to see where your, in this case, your workers are at particular risk, at what time of day. Is it towards the end of their shift where they start to take more risks and their blood sugar's down and so they're at more risk of hurting themselves?
Mm. Paul, this has got real implications for employment though, hasn't it?
Yeah.
And also what children...
I was like, we've just painted a very rosy picture of their business.
I was going to say,
totally paint the other one if you want, but yeah. Mm. I think, every new technology that comes on has throughout history displaced humans and that sort of stuff. And that's partly its job, you know, to help us do bigger and better things. But if I put on my CEO hat, let's be real about this for a second, I would be, right, so you can figure out sort of like the fat and get rid of that, and you can figure out the other value, and then I can fire what percentage of my staff and that sort of stuff. Because don't forget, everyone's got money on their mind at the moment, and lots of uncertainty if you live in certain parts of the world. So how do you sort of like help people? You know, is that the set?
I think that's the gap I was talking about. Is you know, there's a gap there between, yeah, I want my company to be more efficient, but I don't particularly want to make my staff redundant. Thanks very much.
Exactly. It's a very nice CEO that wants the thing.
So how do I get my staff to then move up that bit, as opposed to, right, let's sack those people because we don't need them anymore, and I'll get more intelligent people up the top here because that's what I need. It's how do I move between those two, I think, is what I was trying to explain.
Yeah, I think for me, like, what are the questions that you ask when you work with those companies to figure out, like, oh, what's the extra value that we can get and that sort of stuff?
Mm. Well, I can honestly say that not one of the projects or companies we work with has it resulted in anyone losing their job. This is a stage of this market of artificial intelligence. What we're seeing is new products, new services being created because of the AI. So it's actually growing the business, it's growing their competitive advantage. It's not simply a headcount business case. The reason being that once you start to bottle the expertise of your industry, of your company, you can scale in ways that you couldn't before. You can turn that mental differentiation, that intellectual capacity of your organization, into a product or service that you can then sell.
Mm.
So I used the example earlier of working with an autism charity on providing advice to autistic people in the workplace trying to get on in their career. Once you start to bottle that knowledge, that's then globally applicable. So instead of being a charity operating at local level, suddenly they're scaling their operation and they actually need to bring in partners and employees to recognise that growth.
So many autistic people have incredible skills, you know, which are very, very difficult to, you know, leverage and capitalise on and whatever. And they can make quite difficult employees because of the way they are. And yet the upside of that is they could have some amazing insights in your company, couldn't they? Because they're just not, they don't think like other people.
Absolutely. Mm. Yeah, if you saw the documentary by Chris Packham the other night, you can see what amazing... how he's coped amazingly to have a fully functional career and a very successful career with autism. I think that the issue is actually the rest of us having the patience to let those unique talents come to the fore.
Mm.
And too often, you know, our impatience and as a CEO myself, you know, it's the people skills. That you really, your main objective as a CEO is to bring out the best in your staff.
Yeah, I'm really lazy like that because the better they are, the less I have to do. That's the way I look at it.
Yeah.
It's true, though.
It is true, yeah.
I mean, if you really can encourage your staff, Harry's laughing over there. Thanks for that, Harry. The more you can bring out people's talents and skills, the better it is because you're going to have a more inventive and more engaged staff, right?
Yeah, I've always surrounded myself with smarter people than me. I just thought
it's not
that makes
difficult,
business
that,
sense.
Paul,
yeah.
Has it?
Well, it's a low barrier to entry, isn't it? You know, but,
yeah. Yeah. And then in terms of, I've got some research on you here, Phil. It also says that you're a UK partner of Google's Dialogue Flow. Now, I don't even know what that is. What is that?
So all of the big tech companies have artificial intelligence platforms.
Mm.
So you would have heard of IBM Watson. You would have heard of Google's AI Suite. Dialogue Flow is one of the products within that suite. Now, the beauty of the tech scene right now is the API economy means that each of these big companies who've spent billions of dollars on their technology, they make it available to the world via bite-sized chunks of API services, which means entrepreneurs can very rapidly build solutions, train systems, train AI systems, and take them to market on very little capital expenditure. So I firmly believe there's never been a better time to be an entrepreneur, because you can work with the best of Google, the best of IBM Watson, the best of Amazon Web Services and Microsoft, and all the myriad of API vendors who have got very niche solutions. And because they make them available via APIs, you can train your systems on the very best of the best and solve a business problem or solve a user need.
So what you're saying is you literally sit above those things, picking, pick and mix to get the absolute best that you can, and being sort of agnostic in that respect.
Absolutely. And honestly, the art of a good artificial intelligence solution is in the training layer that sits above the APIs available in the industry.
And I guess that's... I know you're going to talk loads about this, Heather, but I guess that's what we need to teach people, young people in the future, really, is how they can strategically understand those things, not wed themselves to one particular platform or sector or anything, but actually how they solve problems and how they can build things, because that's the skills they're going to need, isn't it? It makes me want to cry. They will sit down there doing exams and GCSEs, and it just drives me nuts, really, because that's not how the world's going to be. Mm. And I'm not sure it makes them particularly employable. But they're going to have to learn how to communicate, how to be problem solvers, how to look at things, and then fit them together in a jigsaw. Mm. Don't you think that's the future, Paul?
Yeah,
for young people.
Yeah, I think the skills that people have aren't taught in the classroom these days. No. You look at the social skills needed to work in a collaborative environment. Again, very few of those are taught. Even at university level, you can say, oh, we did a group work, but then you always get, those groups, and you don't get taught what happens if this happens in that group. You just have to blast your way through it to get to that end point. Mm-hmm. And I think, the university system, we can, moan at it and all of that sort of stuff. But I definitely think there is an element when you go into your workplace the first time that you then look and go, well, here's what we did as a company, but you don't get taught, and here's our email policy. It's always don't do this, rather than here's what you do, and that sort of stuff. Mm. And it's those sort of soft skills as well, with those hard cognitive skills, that I think, you can always tick boxes and retain information. But if you don't know how to apply it and do that strategically, and importantly, one of my biggest things at the moment is critically appraise things. That is my biggest bugbear at the moment, is that no one's teaching these poor little young kids, how to think critically anymore.
So that leads, big smile on the face there, that leads rather nicely to Heather. So Heather Pickoff is UK Managing Director at Apps for Good. Now, you're a leading educational technology charity. What's your views on all that, Heather?
There's nothing else I can add to that. That was taking it off from me. Exactly. So right now, education systems aren't necessarily doing a great job of preparing young people for that, the uncertain future that we've just been talking about the technology tools that they'll need to not just understand, but how do they apply them to solve problems? You talk about the exam system. There's a quote from recent OECD saying that we're producing a lot of exam geniuses who are really good at doing exams, but absolutely falter the second they're given a challenge. So, education right now should be about how young people can, how do they work together as a team? How do they solve problems? How do they understand those problems? And then, build the solution and test those out there. And then how do they use all the different technologies that are available to them to help, make that a more impactful solution?
Because the ironic thing for me is you don't need to remember anything anymore. So why are we testing children to remember things? I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous, to be honest. If you can go on Google, or you can use a calculator, or you can, do whatever, why are we testing if you can remember what the capital of, South America is? It's quite a lot of countries in South America. But it is. It's crazy. Yeah. And I think what people are having to learn how to do is, where do I find things? That's what they need to know. How do I index stuff? Where do I lay my hands on things? How do I find this out? How do I understand all the APIs, that we were just talking about? Where do I find them? How do I fit all those together? but actually our brains are pretty good at that. I don't need to remember things. I need to know where to find them.
That's right. And then, as you said, what do I do with them when I've got them? And does this fit? Is this the right solution for this problem? Is it right for the user? Is it what people need? How do I take that forward? How do I then convince people that this is a great idea and get that funding we were talking about? What is that they need? How do I work in a team and deal with, again, a diverse group of people to help build that solution? Because that is absolutely what will be happening in the future and is, of course, happening now.
And I'm very worried when we employ people is that actually I'm just astounded by the number of younger people who cannot communicate. They can't sit in an interview and talk to you. Mm. And it just makes me so upset because they'll text or they'll email but not actually speak to you. Whereas for me...
while you're interviewing them.
Well, exactly. So for me, communication skills are even more important than they used to be because you're going to have to explain things and have to understand things and solve problems more. But they're being cut out of communications a lot, I think.
Yeah.
And not experiencing communications properly.
No, and I agree with that. And I think, but there are bigger things at play there where you lose the ability to do things like analogous thinking, critical thinking and that sort of stuff. You might be able to talk to someone about Love Island or whatever that stupid rubbish is that people fill their heads with these days. But if you fundamentally don't understand how to... test two ideas together and that sort of stuff, let alone communicate that to somebody else, then you're putting yourself at a massive disadvantage. Yeah. And but then you go, AI is not going to help you. It's just going to literally put a layer and tread on your neck, and that sort of stuff. Yeah. So you've got to think about how these technologies are, empowering as much as disempowering some others.
So tell us about Apps for Good. Mm-hmm. How does that work? And I presume this is your thing that you're trying to cut through.
Absolutely. So, so we're a technology education charity, as you say. We work with schools exactly. So our program is about teaching young people how to identify a problem they care about, work as a team to build a solution using technology, and then have the confidence to pitch that idea forward. So they are learning those digital skills, but they're building that confidence, that teamwork, that creativity, and those problem-solving skills are going to be so critical for them. So I think we're hoping that, we're helping grow the future inventors that'll be on the Tech Talk 22 list, that will be these companies then using AI. So it's about... right now, them, working in this environment in schools where they can start, they're moving away from, as we were talking about, that world where they're just being told this is important, you need to learn this. Instead, it's, grounding their learning in something that's much more relevant to the messy problems of the real world. They are learning that, failing is part of the problem-solving process. They are working as a team, getting that feedback, and through that, building all those skills.
Because I know, Phil, that you're very brainy. And, you understand this, you've got a degree in engineering, and you understand AI. But actually, you don't need to understand it, do you? You need to know how to use it is the key and how to harness it.
Yeah, I think in terms of the skills around AI, there's a lot of deep scientific technical skills focused on the underlying algorithms. They're getting huge, six-figure salaries that you've seen in the press. Where there's a lack of understanding is in the business application of AI, and we've focused on adult education programs to really teach organizations and non-profits to see where AI can be applied in their organization for their benefit. Now that education is really understanding the use cases that AI enabled. This point of how do you bottle the uniqueness of my business and my people and create an asset, an AI asset, a model. Think of it like a recipe that can then be taken to the world and scaling your uniqueness.
And you can take somebody through it so somebody else can use it, basically. I mean, a recipe is a really good analogy, isn't it?
Absolutely. Well, as you were talking earlier, I was thinking, the skills of our children coming up into this world, they need to be like a TV chef. They need to be able to put together recipes in creative ways using the APIs, the ingredients that the tech industry provides them. But also with that flair and that communication to be able to explain what they're doing and build relationships, build close relationships with people.
And Apps for Good really is from your perspective, I think, Heather, it's making people more confident, isn't it, as well, and more collaborative, which is an important part of getting on in this new world.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've talked about this rapid pace of change. I think it's important for all of us, absolutely, that lifelong learning mindset and going to be increasingly important for young people. So how are they adapting to this change? How are they being resourceful? And then, you know, you look at it's that kind of growth mindset of every new challenge, everything you're doing is about learning and about, you know, taking the next step, becoming a better person, and that everybody has that potential to do that. And I think for young people to see that as they go into the workforce, and I think we talked about too, the number of different roles that they'll have, that will only help, you know, really empower them and help them adapt to that.
And may I then bring up the thorny issue of teachers? Sure. Because it's great, it's great you going in, but how many schools can you go into? And there's a thing about training teachers, isn't there, as well?
Yeah, so actually we work in partnership with teachers. So we're in, last year we were in 655 schools, reaching 27,000 students in the UK. So teachers are how we do what we do, and they've how we've been able to scale. So our model is a software-based model in terms of we provide teachers with the content they need in the classroom, and then teachers take that and deliver it. So, you know, we work with loads of enthusiastic teachers, but yes, there is a lot of pressure right now within schools, particularly in England, but also in Scotland. So it's a challenging time in terms of a lack of specialist teachers. The changes in curriculum have been fantastic, but they have come really quickly. There's some great programs out there, like by people like CAS, to help train teachers, but schools don't often have the budgets to let teachers out to go take that training. So a lot of challenges facing schools right now.
Politically, it drives me mad, you know, that everybody's sitting there, you know, prepping themselves for exams, which are totally useless. Mm. Do you find that depressing, or is that just me?
I don't find it depressing. I think there's a long laundry list of things to be depressed about these days. But, kids taking exams, I'm like, well, get through it, and, you know, then get to smile, you know, and that's the thing.
But you see, teachers have got a great skills in terms and experience in terms of problem solving, you know, comparative, you know, comparing data and just because they don't think that's applicable to technology doesn't mean to say they can't do these things, because and actually they can teach that stuff. Do they need massive training just because they don't understand the technology? I mean, who cares? Surely what we should be doing is revising the curriculum around those problem solving skills and those analytical skills.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, our model is sort of a flipped classroom model, or a sense of teachers don't have to be the sage at the stage. They don't have to have all the answers. And as we've been talking about, the skill is the young people going out and finding those answers and going on that journey. And teachers just need to be there to guide them and coach them. It's not the job for the teacher to have all the answers. And so that is, of course, it's challenging at times because that's not how teachers have always been trained. But when teachers do, you know, we work with who do that, they do feel, actually, that's actually really great. And it gives a chance for, you know, somebody in the room who's a really great, you know, coder to go, hey, I can help some of the teams, or they're a big expert on one of the issues they're tackling. Hey, I can help people. We also bring in technology professionals to mentor the student team. So again, that helps teachers tap into those experts in the field, that they again don't have to have all the answers because they've got loads on their plates already.
So what's the future for you guys? Are you going more of the online educations? Because this is very hands-on, yeah, which I like, and I definitely think there's a place for, but you are, you know, only so big and that sort of thing. What are you doing? Are you scaling up? Are you going online? What's doing?
Yeah, so everything we provide to our educators is through our online software. So that's where they access the course content material. That's how we've scaled. So we are scaling now globally. So we'll continue to do that because the technology is the sort of foundation of what we do, but it's not relying on us as the educators, it's relying on those people out there in the field. And I do feel really strongly there's a role for that hands-on experience in a classroom or in an informal learning center. And sometimes that is actually not totally digital. Sometimes it is working with paper prototypes because actually, and particularly for disadvantaged students, sometimes that's actually a really great first step, is to get them to work away from a laptop, away from a mobile phone, and just sort of play around with what they have. And then the next step is then, of course, go into that technology. Mm.
And I'd love to see, I mean, if I was interviewing people, I'd want somebody to, and what we do now is we often set challenges for people at interview stage because, you know, I'm not being funny, but exams don't mean anything to us. We want people that are passionate and can communicate and, you know, want to do a good job, want to learn, want to solve problems. And so we often have to set people challenges just to try and bring that out. And that's exactly what you're asking them to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're asking them to, yeah, think about something they care about, that are interested in, and then to think about how to solve that. And yes, go through that whole process of problem solving, of being creative and, you know, getting things wrong along the way. And then, yes, and that is, I think, something that's going to come up again and again, regardless of what they do in their life. And that is absolutely that valuable skill for employers.
Absolutely. So can I talk a little bit about you, Heather?
Sure.
So you're from, are you actually from Toronto?
I am from
Toronto. Yep. So Canadian. And you have a Bachelor of Science and double major in Human Biology and Classical Civilization. So how did you get from there to what you're doing now?
I guess like lots of people, it's my education to me was much more about just a grounding. And I think I was... you know, just through happenstance, it was sort of a grounding in analysis and problem solving and skills that ended up, I mean, being quite applicable to different things that I've done. And I think for myself, I've sort of naturally developed in through influences of family and that sort of thing, that kind of learning mindset of I've just, okay, new problem, new industry, I'm going to learn it. And so I think it's just taking me that journey through of that core of then moving towards. Eventually, I ran another charity for a while and did a whole bunch of things, but then sort of came to this and it brought together all those skills in a really nice, you know, organization that was only at the time, you know, 3-4 years old. And I got to really get hands on it and get involved in things.
But you've also got involved with government, haven't you, and policy.
Yeah.
How important is it if we are going to lobby and get people to have the right type of curriculum that we think is going to be useful, how important is it to try and talk to boring old government ministers who, frankly, sometimes I think are so removed, don't even know what's going on? How do we lobby them to understand that they need to have a look at the curriculum in a different way?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, policy moves slowly and it has to, you know, policymakers, you know, and I, yes, I was one of them. We aren't the innovators. You're not going to take huge risks in policy because you're working with, you know, voters' money and you need to be reelected. And so that's not the role of government. I think it is for organizations like Apps for Good, Code Club, you know, people like that within that space to trial things and then to use evidence to show what's working. And then through that, government can sort of, where they need to, pick things that do work. You know, schools are old, long established institutions with lots of, you know, massive industry around them. And that stuff does take time to change. And so you do need to give it that time. And of course, it can be frustrating.
But it can't take time to change. I mean, it's changing so slowly. And the world is changing really quickly.
Yeah. I mean, that's where I think organizations like us, where schools can bring us in. So you have that structure around it, and then you can bring that stuff into the classroom. You have that kind of, you know, you break down that bricks and mortar traditional education quite easily in that sense of these organizations are out there. There's charities like us. We get funding from, you know, technology companies and trusts and foundations who likewise believe in that vision that education can be a bit different, and that lets those things start to happen.
I'd like you to set up a school, Paul. Yeah, I could see you being in charge and then just completely revolutionising what they were learning and what they were be expected to do. You should just be allowed to do that. You should get a minister, just let you have a school that you run.
I'm fully available for funding for this idea. I'll take PayPal. I think education is one of those things which is you've got to be careful, haven't you? Because there is some standardisation which needs to be there. But at the same time, it's governed by people who are being elected for 4-5, you know, 8 years since and that sort of stuff. So you get short-term politics, don't you, and that sort of stuff. And until we sort of fix that, then you're very unlikely to sort of fix at a grassroots level the issues being seen in an education system. But I see a lot of, like, grassroots efforts being happened and a lot of, control being relinquished by high government to lower levels, and then you can start to make some real changes. And I think that's where a lot of our politics is going to come from the next, like, 5 to 10 years.
And Phil, is there particular things that you would like to see, you know, sort of, you know, new graduates or undergraduates and children actually being taught?
Yeah, I mean, we tend to do our recruitment from a graduate pool or you know, post-school age, because they haven't been... their brains haven't been trained on the structures of corporate life. And this new world we're going into, the training of AI systems, is very, very different to traditional software development, for example. So we really see that the 30-somethings are already are already so you're saying
that going to corporate is a really mm-hmm. bad thing for you because you can't learn after that, really, outside the box. That's quite a damning statement.
I wouldn't go as far as say that, but they've already been trained a certain way of thinking. Mm. As you come out of university, you've got a fairly fresh brain, and you're open to new ideas. I mean, the creativity that you're seeing. I mean, the millennials get a hard time in the press for, you know, being fixated with their phones and all the rest of it. But they genuinely, from my experience of working with a lot of millennials in filament, is they genuinely care about society and about ethical behaviour, working for a company that is helping the progression of humanity, not just making a quick buck.
Mm.
And if you can, I think you had a talk with an entrepreneur a few weeks ago about creating an engaging company culture. It's so important for millennials to feel they are valued and their business is adding value to society.
And they ask a lot of questions about your company and what you do and how you approach this, that and the other. Quite rightly so, you know, they should be. But as you say, they are very interested in those things, I think. It's good.
And I think education, from my perspective, from the AI industry, we're actually seeing there's more of a pull for education to the individual, these mass online courses, which enables you to go and skill yourself up. And you add to that a digital assistant, a digital mentor. This is exactly how I was talking earlier, how an organization with great skills can now scale their offering to a global audience through the use of AI. That's a great example of what AI can do for good.
And apps for good. So if anybody wants to get involved in that, either from a teaching perspective or wants the school involved or whatever, do they just go on to appsforgood.org or how do they sort of get involved?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you're an educator in a school or in a learning center and you want to run Apps for Good or find out more, then it's free to sign up. So everything we provide is free for non-fee paying schools and centers. So yeah, easily just quick sign up with your email address on our website. We've then got all the materials online and my team there to support you as you need it. And then it's really about taking those materials, adapting them to your classroom and going.
And would that be part of the curriculum, or is it an after school thing, or,
yeah,
or how
so
would that work?
We see a number of different models. So it can be run as part of curriculum time. We have after school clubs, we have enrichment days as well. So we have different lengths of courses. So we've got an app in a day course that we're just developing, a 10 to 12 hour course, and then something longer, 30 to 50. So it's very much what suits the needs of that school, that classroom, and they can go from there.
But the important thing is they don't just get this as a package, they've got all that support, and that's what you really need, isn't it?
Exactly.
And help. Yeah.
Exactly. We spend a lot of time and have done a lot of work in partnership with schools to make sure it works in the classroom.
Hmm. And then to you, Jeff, because we're going to have to finish our Jeff. What do I call you, Jeff? Phil.
I can
Phil,
be Jeff.
Phil Westcott. Yeah, I don't know where I got that from. In terms of filament, you know, if somebody wanted to work with you, what are the benefits and how can they get involved?
So it's really about making your organisation empowered to differentiate through AI. So we start with education or laying out a roadmap, identifying the areas of their business that can be enhanced, new business models. And we tend to work with the innovation department in large enterprises or with the CEO of mid-size or startups to really plot out how they're gonna differentiate in the market. But we get very quickly to doing, because building assets with AI, that's really where we're cutting through a lot of the noise we've seen in the market, a lot of the marketing bump, and really saying this is something valuable, prove the value, and then expand from there.
And so a company will have already identified that they want to take this on, but they just don't know how to do it.
That's
often.
Exactly it. I mean, there's so much news about AI. Everyone is surrounded by stories and feeling they're going to miss out.
Mm.
So it's cutting through that to actually, this is a valuable use case for my business. Mm. And we help them identify and then build that proof of value and then go from there.
And in your book, Paul, Disruptive Technologies,
mm-hmm.
Your thoughts on AI and machine learning that are coming through?
It is highly abused, that term. Mm. So I think, first and foremost, we'll come to realize what the different areas are, whether it's neural net and all of that sort of stuff. So I would say educate yourself about the different types and the umbrella term as a whole. Don't freak out too much about it. It's definitely an evolution, not a revolution, I think, personally. I think it's another technology that's coming through. It's not the end one. It's not the only one. It's just another one that's coming through.
Absolutely. Yet another one that you've got to learn about. So if you want to learn a little bit more about filament, if you go on to filament.uk.com, that's right, Phil?
Have I got that right? That's right.
And then you can perhaps understand how you might work with a company like yours. And presumably you'll come and say, I've got these problems, and you would go in and give them a sort of overview of what we might be able to do to help.
Absolutely.
Great. Okay. So I'd like to say thank you to my two studio guests, Phil Westcott, who I called Jeff for some reason earlier, co-managing director of Filament. And also thank you very much, Heather Pickoff of Apps for Good. And don't forget, if you want to find out about that and you're a school, you really should, especially if you've got so much support for you, appsforgood.org. And thank you to my co-presenter, Paul Armstrong.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good one.
You behave yourself today. You're normally a bit naughtier than that.
I know, because you beat me.
I should do that, shouldn't I? And you've been listening to the Tech Talk show, which is now syndicated to dozens of radio stations across the UK and further afield. Oh, from California. Did you used to work there?
I did.
To the Kent Coast, Manchester to Michigan, and even Malta. So thanks again to Paul. And if you want to recommend any future guests, someone who's doing something groundbreaking in the tech sector, please get in touch with us via Twitter on @TechTalkShowUK. Or if you want to listen to any of our hundreds of podcasts, go to techtalkshow.co.uk. And don't forget to check out our Tech Talk 22, The Stars of the Future, on techradar.com. Thanks for listening. See you next week.